WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Weeks ago when she was visiting Philadelphia. It's a minute after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. At 5 o'clock, we'll join National Public Radio for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. Tonight on All Things Considered, the latest details on the loss of the Pride of Baltimore. The tall sailing ship sank last week in the stormy Atlantic Ocean. 8 crew members were rescued yesterday. 4 are still missing. Also this evening, playing hardball at the Cannes Film Festival. That's coming up later this evening at 5 o'clock on All Things Considered, and that will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is John Ehrlichman, who was one of the leading players in the Watergate cover-up. Ehrlichman was convicted of conspiracy to obstruct justice in the Watergate cover-up and of conspiracy to burglarize the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist in an attempt to find information to discredit Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers to the press. Ehrlichman and White House Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman were two of the members of the Nixon administration closest to the president. It was Haldeman who first recruited Ehrlichman to work with Nixon on his 1960 presidential campaign. Ehrlichman became President Nixon's counsel, then Chief Domestic Affairs Advisor. Ehrlichman served 18 months in prison. He did his time in a minimum security prison in Arizona. He now lives with his second wife and their child in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he writes books. His first novel, The Company, was based on his Washington experiences. It was a bestseller and was made into the miniseries Washington Behind Closed Doors. His memoir, Witness to Power, The Nixon Years, was also a bestseller. The book sales helped Ehrlichman pay legal fees from the Watergate trial. He's now written a new novel. It's called The China Card. It's in part a spy story which combines real and fictional characters to tell about the opening of relations between the U.S. and China under President Nixon. The China Card is published by Simon & Schuster. John Ehrlichman, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I have to confess to you that I feel like I'm participating in a modern ritual, a new ritual where a convicted white-collar criminal writes a memoir or a semi-autobiographical novel, tours talk shows, discusses their life, ends up getting a bestseller, makes a lot of money, and becomes a celebrity. And I wonder how it's felt to you to participate in that yourself and to become a celebrity after becoming a convicted white-collar criminal.
Well, I don't know that there's much difference as far as notoriety is concerned. I think it's it's kind of an American ritual, as you say. The celebrity book these days is, I guess, a hot ticket for both the publishing field and also for the media field. And the media has this insatiable appetite for people to talk to and things to put on their airwaves. And so they are co-conspirators in the whole thing.
Do you feel that the media, which investigated Watergate and paid so much attention to the Watergate hearings and to the lives of the people involved in Watergate, are now, in a way, your conspirators in helping you make bestsellers of your books?
No, I don't see the identity there. I think that media learned its lesson, perhaps, in the Watergate days, that it couldn't afford to do that kind of thing.
What couldn't afford to do what?
Saturate the airwaves with one event like that. The people in the media that I talk to tell me that that will never happen again. They lost so much money. The commercial networks lost so much money in that coverage. And so many loyal viewers of soap operas and game shows were broken away from their loyalties, that it's considered to have been a failure as far as an experiment is concerned.
That's really interesting because I think in public broadcasting circles, it's just the opposite. That it was so well watched and well listened to, and that people had almost the sense of soap opera that this was a real life continuing drama that everybody wanted to hear, and so many people discovered public media through the broadcast
That might be as far as national public is concerned. And it'd be interesting to hear why they haven't covered similar events since.
Well, actually, public media has covered a lot of
Not much. Panama Canal is the only other one I can think of.
Oh, there were many hearings covered, anyways, there's a part two also, and that is that another phenomenon, a kind of media phenomenon now, which I guess I am participating in right now, is that someone who has been convicted of a crime denies later that they had anything to do with it, or denies that they were guilty of what they were convicted of, except they admit to having had a big ego and perhaps an over-ambitiousness. Then they undergo a redemptive process, either finding religion, getting into social services, being more socially conscious, dissociate from their past, and then discuss it on the media and talk about their old self and their new self and the redemptive process.
Well, that's certainly not what you and I are doing.
But you've dissociated yourself from your past in some ways, don't you think? Do you feel like you've gone through a redemptive process?
No. Do you?
Well, in reading your book, I thought that you were getting to that. Let me quote a line from it. This is Witness to Power, your memoir about the Nixon years. And you're right, I can't, this is the very last page, I can't say that the public perception of me was wholly in error. I confess that when I watched the PBS videotapes of my testimony before the Senate committee, I didn't like what I saw. I was in many respects a person I can neither defend nor condone, nor do I try. The things that happened can't be wished away, but the way I was then has become a picture of a person I barely know, far away. Implying that you're somebody different now and that you...
Well, the point there, probably not very well expressed, is that that whole episode in my life has faded to the point that it's just almost somebody else's life. I am living an entirely different kind of life, doing different things, living in a different place, filling my time with things that are important to me now. But I think what you read and what I intended to say, at least, is a long way from your discussion of being born again and all that.
So you don't feel that you've had any big revelations since the conviction, or that you've undergone a redemptive process?
Well, certainly not a born again process or something as remarkable as that. So I've learned a great deal. I've sorted out my values. I've had to pick myself up and move along, and that's, I think, obvious.
Do you think that, I'll confess that I haven't seen this, and maybe you have, the Newsweek cover story on President
Nixon?
Yeah,
I read it the other night.
I was just looking for a copy of it, and it's already all gone. But I get the impression with the president that there's every opportunity now to try to give him a second chance, and that he's gone from being the shadowy figure of a very disturbing part of American politics to entering into the role of the elder statesman. And I wonder if you think that's true and what you think of that.
I think that it's true, but I think it's been happening for a long time. I think just being on the cover of Newsweek makes it appear to be a rather sudden thing, but I think it's been going on. He's been having dinner parties for opinion makers. He's over a period of years, he's been in touch with the people who make and conduct foreign policy, that kind of thing. So I think it's kind of a bottom line. It's kind of the fruition of a long effort on his part.
Do you approve of him entering into that role of elder statesman and getting back assimilated into American politics?
Well, I don't have a sense of either approving or disapproving. It's a phenomenon that I've been interested to watch.
I guess you think he's worthy of that.
Well, worthy in the sense that he probably knows a great deal more about foreign affairs than the people who are doing it. He's certainly qualified. I don't know that there's anything associated with his past conduct that prohibits him from doing it in an ethical or a moral or a legal sense. So if somebody in the State Department wants to pick up the phone and ask him where the bodies are buried in some subject or other, I would think that's perfectly okay for them to do.
A lot of Americans, I think, are kind of disturbed in a way that so many of the people who are implicated in Watergate have served a little bit of time and have been able to get out and have revitalized careers and pay back all their legal fees with bestsellers and charge a lot of money for personal appearances. And I'm thinking here of Gordon Liddy, who gets, I think, over 4,000 or maybe considerably more than that for a personal appearance.
Henry Kissinger gets 20.
But there's that sense of is that justice? You know that
well,
that everybody
alter,
should.
No, there was a way around that. You know, they could have all been executed.
That wasn't what I was thinking. But does that seem appropriate to you? The short sentences and then the revitalized careers, people becoming celebrities.
Well, short sentences is a relative term, I guess. Compared to what? 18 months seemed awfully long to me. Once out under our system of justice, presumably everybody has the obligation to at least act rehabilitated and become gainfully employed and support his family and make sure they don't go on the dole. I'm only half facetious in saying, you know, execute them. If you don't want them to do these things, these are extremely creative, bright people, most of them. The only thing I know to do is either leave them in jail or do away with them, one or the other, because there's a lot of quality there, and a lot of those folks are gonna rise to the top. I don't think Gordon Liddy's necessarily one of them, but some of the others that I'm thinking about.
Do you think that there's a double standard of justice in America that people who
at least double. Perhaps triple.
What would the triple be?
Well, I'm thinking of the economically disadvantaged and people in minorities, excluding women, I think are hard-pressed to get a decent result in a federal court, certainly, and in a great many of the state courts. And that's a big problem. They can't afford good legal representation. There are very strong biases running in some of our courts against people of minority races, and the jails are full of them.
I'm wondering if they get the second chance that many
people... Well, some do. It depends on ability, again, when they come out. Prior conviction is a problem for a great many of them in getting positions of trust, but I think it's less a problem today than it has been perhaps in other eras of this country's history.
My guest is John Ehrlichman. What do you admit to and what do you deny in terms of your role in Watergate?
It just doesn't come up. It's just nothing that anybody ever asks me except when I come out on a book tour. I've tried to set it out as clearly as I can a number of years ago in a memoir and figured that, and as a matter of fact, also in an article that I did for Parade magazine, which had a very wide circulation. And it's just not something that I find necessary to hash over anymore.
But to clarify for our listeners, you deny having had anything to do with the Ellsberg break-in?
Oh, I had something to do with it, yeah. You want me to parse that all out? I'm that's certainly not anything that I'm particularly interested in doing.
Well, I wouldn't mind hearing a short summary.
Well, there is no short summary.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rather long, complicated set of facts. Do you really want to get into that on this show?
Well, I'd like to hear a little bit. I mean, it was my understanding in reading through your memoirs that you claim to have no prior knowledge of the Ellsberg break-in and to have not worked on that.
That's, well, as I say, I did not have any prior knowledge. That's correct.
And to have had no prior knowledge about the Watergate break-in.
That's correct.
Okay. So basically, you deny the charges that you were convicted of.
Oh, no. I was never convicted of the Watergate break-in. Goodness gracious.
What's true? You were convicted of obstructing
justice.
There
was never any
question
about that.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, there never was any serious question about my having had prior knowledge of that other one.
The Ellsberg?
No. No. The gravamen of the charges in that case all related to conduct afterward.
Okay. Do you keep a scorecard of who you think got off easy and where you think justice was served?
Of course not. What a waste of time.
You said in one of your books that the cover-up could be explained by John Dean if he'd tell the truth. Do you still believe that?
Well, I assume that because he was the guy in the cockpit who was running it. And I would think he would be the one who logically knew everything that was going on.
Have you spoken to him since Watergate?
No, not before nor since.
Have you spoken to any of the people involved with that? Are you in touch with Haldeman? Have you been in touch with
the
president?
Yeah, I'm in touch with the Haldemans socially and a number of other people from that period of time, most of whom don't get their names in the paper.
My guest is John Ehrlichman, and the occasion for his visit to Fresh Air is the publication of his new novel, The China Card. Let's talk about your entry into politics. You started working with Nixon in 1960, when basically Bob Haldeman invited you to work as an advance man on the campaign.
That's correct.
What was your job description then?
You mean what does an advance man do?
Yeah, what did you do?
Oh, you go into a locality like the main line and set up campaign stops and pick out the spots in the villages where the rallies will be held or where the band stands and the hotel rooms where the candidate stays and that kind of thing. It's logistics primarily.
What were your impressions of Nixon then as a political leader? What were your impressions of his policies? Did you endorse his policies and have faith in his leadership?
No, I didn't know him at all. I think if you'd given me a quiz on what his policies were, I'd probably have flunked it. I was there primarily because it looked like a very interesting thing to do. I was practicing law out west. This was a chance to see presidential politics up close. And I think I've said a number of times in the past, if the other party had asked me to come work on their campaign, I might very well have gone off and worked for John Kennedy that year.
You wrote in your memoir, Witness to Power, that in the last few weeks of the campaign, you lost faith in Nixon, or lost some faith in him. You started to see a different side of him. What side did he show you in those last few weeks when he was tired and run down and maybe different characteristics were starting to show through?
Well, at the outset, I had been impressed with his instincts. I thought his judgment was very good. Toward the end of that campaign, he had immersed himself so much in the minutiae and was insisting upon calling all the shots himself and was steering the campaign into what I thought were extremely unproductive directions. So it just seemed to me that he had lost his way.
You went to work with him again in 1968. If you'd felt that he'd lost his way, why did you want to re-enter campaign work for him?
Well, pretty much on the same basis, except that it was unfinished business at that point. A lot of the people involved in the campaign were friends of mine. We had tried this out 7 years before without success. They invited me to come back and set up the convention, and political conventions have always intrigued me. So it was an opportunity to see that whole aspect of things.
One of the things that happened, and I think that campaign was that Nixon wanted Ehrlichman to rough up some hecklers, not personally, not to...
wanted me to?
No, I mean wanted Haldeman to have some hecklers roughed up and to have the Secret Service participate in that. You mentioned that in your book.
At the convention?
Can't remember if it might have been at the convention,
I think it was actually at a campaign. Well,
you may
remember. I don't know. Maybe you're too young to remember. But in that campaign, both sides, the Humphrey people and we, were terrifically harassed by hecklers. It was probably the one campaign of recent memory where the harassment had been that severe. And Nixon was extremely disturbed by it, as I know Humphrey was. and all kinds of things were discussed, and he very much wanted some kind of a countermeasure to try and suppress some of that heckling. That's right.
Did you and Haldeman approve of that?
Did we approve of it? We approved of the end result if it could be accomplished, but it couldn't be accomplished. There wasn't any way to do it.
So were the hecklers roughed up? Or?
No, no.
How had Nixon changed by the time of Watergate? Was he the same person to you that you had started working with in 1960? Was he very different?
Oh, my, no. Oh, well, you know, he was older. I think he was a good deal wiser. He was certainly willing to delegate much more freely, both in a campaign setting and when he became president. And he got to be quite a good administrator, which he had not been 10 years before.
There were some characteristics that made you very nervous about him.
Sure. He's a very odd duck. And you know, not the sort of fellow that you would invite home to mother.
Why not?
Well, I mean, he had an extremely narrow range of interests. And anything else pretty much bored him, so that the average ordinary pursuits of life were simply not interesting to him, and he didn't participate in them. He's the sort of fellow you invite to a party, and he gets bored at the party, so he goes upstairs and goes to sleep on your bed. Nixon didn't do that, but I mean, that's the analogy that comes to mind. So if you were not talking about politics or international affairs or problems of government with him, if you were talking about gardens or music or the kids or dog breeding or anything else, he'd simply tune you out, and was not a socially interesting person.
What about his ability to handle alcohol or to handle the next day if he was hungover? I get
the
impression.
Yeah. It's a lot like Native Americans in that regard. One drink is just about his limit, or was then, and couldn't handle alcohol physiologically. And so he had to be much more circumspect about drinking than the average person.
Did he do any things that struck you as politically foolish or personally foolish that reflected on him politically?
Yeah, if he had more than one drink, he would be pretty foolish.
Any statements you remember?
Any statements? No.
Because I think in your book you credited him saying you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore to him.
Oh, I see. Well,
being
I think
hungover state.
I think the night before, as the election returns came in on the California gubernatorial election, was one of those times.
He had discussed with you once what he thought was the genetic inferiority of blacks, that we should work on their behalf anyways, but we should understand.
More than once.
Yeah. Oh, what would you say to him when he'd say that?
Nothing.
Why?
Well, Henry Kissinger and I had a conversation about this a while back. And he said to me, you know, John, we are going to look very foolish on the tapes when he says outrageous things and we just stand there and we're quiet. But the thing that Henry learned and I learned and everybody who worked with him learned was that there was no use in contending with him on those kinds of statements, those extravagant, wild kinds of statements. It impaired your ability to get him to deal with the work you had to do if he felt that you were hostile to him on something of that kind. I did it sometimes, and I got frozen out for my troubles. I couldn't get an appointment. I couldn't get my memos answered. Couldn't get questions answered. So what you do is look at the ceiling or look out the window until he gets through with that kind of thing, and then you get down to business and you do what has to be done.
Are you saying that in some ways that the staff closest to the president ended up yesing him a lot?
No, you don't yes him. Uh-huh. That would be equally difficult. But you let all the steam blow off, and then you get down to what has to be done on your agenda. And you learn to work with somebody like that. I guess other people have had bosses that they've worked for that had similar quirks or were a problem to work with, and he was a problem in that respect. He would say things like, we're going to cut off all the money to MIT. No more federal money for MIT. And you'd let that go by, and 2 or 3 days later, he'd say, did you do anything about that? And I'd say, no, I haven't gotten around to that yet. He'd say, well, good, I've been thinking about it, and I think we'll do it another way. And he'd back off of it. And you had to learn how to work with this fellow. It's not entirely easy.
I wonder what the ethics are for someone like you who is as close to the president as you are and get to see a lot of his flaws as well as his strengths. Do you think it ever becomes your responsibility to let the public know about some of the imbalances? Or is it your job to cover for him because you're his age, you're very close to him?
No, I don't think you do either one. I think it would be extremely pernicious of somebody who worked closely with a president to go out and, as David Stockman did while he was still working there, and spout off like that. If you disagree strongly enough, if it bothers you so much, you ought to quit, get out, leave, and you'll have ample opportunity to write your memoirs and do course. But it seems to me a real breach of confidence, and confidence is the operative word in a relationship between a president and a staff member. And it's bilateral. It would be a terrible breach of confidence to go out and disadvantage a president in that way. I have enough confidence in the electorate and in the people that they know pretty well what an incumbent is like from press reports and from observing him on television and so on. If there were some disabling situation, he's mentally incompetent or in a coma or something of that kind, maybe so. Maybe because that bears on his on the constitutional aspects of his ability to govern. Then I think there may be some duty to go forward or collectively and say, the president is unable to govern. But short of that, I think not.
Nothing that dramatic ever presented itself to you
while
you were close?
Oh, no. Not even close, no.
I think he had a lot of rambling conversations with you, and my impression is he even called in the middle of the night sometimes with very disconnected thoughts. Was that disturbing?
Yeah, well, one gets used to that. He rambled a lot. It was his way of deliberating. And I feel sorry for whoever has to listen to all those thousands of hours of tapes of Richard Nixon sitting there trying to decide whether he should or should not reorganize the government or should not reorganize welfare or whatever the subject was. Because he'd march up the hill and get almost to the top of it, and he'd back down. And then he'd march up another hill and come back down. And then he'd go off in another direction and come back. And it was a lot like a cow chewing its cud, the way he worked a problem. And you just sat there and sometimes took a note and let him ramble. And it was part of the process.
Did you lose any confidence in him for that, or do you think that was just his method?
Well, I had by then come to understand that that was methodology for him, and that eventually you could bring him to a focus on a subject. And the way you did it is on paper. You send in an action memo, and it says the range of options on this decision are so-and-so as we see it. And here backing it up are all the facts that you need. And he'd come back from Camp David on a weekend, and he would have read the material and checked off his choices or suggested alternatives or insisted on more work or whatever it was.
My guest is John Ehrlichman, if you're just joining us. And as you probably know, for the last few years he's been writing books, and his new one is a novel called The China Card. It's my understanding that after the Watergate burglary was discovered, that your first inclination was to have everybody tell all, to just reveal what had happened. But then your second inclination was to not do that and to think more in terms of a cover-up. Accurate?
No.
Which part of that is inaccurate?
Well, I think the first part of it is not quite correct, and the last part's totally incorrect.
Okay, what's not correct about the first part? The first part being
right,
that your first inclination was to tell the truth.
There was a break-in at the Watergate. The first decision that was collectively made in the White House was that this was a re-election committee problem and that it would be kept out of the White House, that nobody in the White House would have anything to do with it, that they would stand or fall on the merits, and that the president would not be involved, nor would his staff. So that was the first decision. The second decision was really not mine. It was Richard Nixon's, and that was that he would get involved. And he did, in quite short order. And he began to manipulate the FBI and the CIA and do all sorts of things toward an obstruction of justice is what it amounted to. I think that was the sequence of decisions.
Looking back, how do you think it should have been handled?
Well, I think the first instinct was the correct one, and that was that this wasn't a White House problem, wasn't a governmental problem. It was a re-election committee problem, and let the prosecutors go ahead and find out who was involved and do what they should do.
Do you have an official statement that you make about what the president knew?
Do I have?
Yeah.
I don't have any official statement about anything.
No, well, okay. What I mean is, I know you
long ago gave up having official statements.
What I mean to say is that you had been saying that you thought the president knew nothing.
He didn't know in advance.
In advance is what I mean, yeah. And you're still
I don't know of any evidence that he did.
Okay. How big did you think it was going to get when you found out about the Watergate break-in? How big of a story did you think that was going to be? How much of an effect did you think it was really going to have on the government, on your life?
It potentially could have had quite a lot of effect on the election. See, we were only 4 months away from the 72 election. I thought it could have had some effect there, particularly if somebody like Charles Colson had been involved. And I didn't know one way or the other whether he did. As we got farther along into it, the Democrats nominated George McGovern, and then I stopped really worrying about the 72 election. It didn't look to me like it was going to be a problem. And Watergate itself, as the break-in itself, didn't really appear to be a problem to me until well after we had gone through the election and the transition into the new term and the new State of the Union, the new budget, and all of that. We came out of there in about February of 73. And then for 60 days, it was a bigger, bigger, bigger problem every day.
And were you surprised at how big the problem was getting?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I underestimated it even then. But as we approached the reality of Senate hearings and all that kind of thing, then it was clear to me that it was a substantial problem.
Looking back, what do you think of Woodward and Bernstein's reporting? What's your opinion of the way, the techniques that you know of that they used to investigate the story and the reporting that they did on it?
I don't know just a whole lot about that. I know they were grossly wrong on some things and very right on others. I'm inclined to think that they probably slightly overrated. But as I say, I'm certainly not a student of it.
I mean, you think they made it a bigger story?
No, I think they got more credit than possibly they deserved. Other people were covering the same story and turning up things, and they kind of glamorized it with the books and so on.
Were you getting the papers first thing in the morning and seeing what the latest...
Oh, I didn't have to
was.
Because I had the press corps all camped on my lawn. All I had to do was step out to get the paper in the morning and I could get my picture taken in my pajamas.
You look angry as you say that.
Yeah, it's a very unpleasant time for me because they badgered my kids so badly.
Your kids?
Yeah. What? It made me very angry.
Interviewing them or?
On their way to the school bus and on their way back and all that, yeah.
What did you try to do to protect your children?
There wasn't anything you could do.
How do you think the press should have treated you to get reaction and information from you without...
Like ladies and gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe what it was like when Nixon asked you to resign?
It was a very emotional time. We were alone at Camp David, and it was a foregone conclusion. I knew why I was there. But he broke down, and it made it doubly difficult because of that. I was feeling very sorry for myself at the moment anyway. But then when he got very emotional, it compounded the problem.
Was there something that you think was the last straw that made him feel that he had to ask you to resign then?
Well, he was under a lot of pressure from people that he was relying on at that time, and which one of them, I suspect it was William Rogers, but it may have been Kissinger, I just don't know who, finally persuaded him that we should go over the side. And he fired four people that weekend.
Did you feel betrayed? Did you feel like he was having you take the fall in any way?
I felt a little bit like the Russian baby getting thrown out of the sleigh to keep the wolves busy. I felt that the things that I was being accused of were false. I knew they were false. They were later proved to be false. And I knew that, and yet it was happening to me, and I thought that was, you know, very unfair.
How did you prepare for the hearings? Did you talk with Haldeman at all? And
a little, not much. Mm-hmm. I just went through my old calendars and tried to get my dates straight and figure out what had happened, where I was at any given time, and exactly what my participation was.
I think that John Dean had used a media advisor. Knowing that he was...
Is that true?
I think that that's true.
Nothing would surprise me.
Knowing that he was
going
to be on camera. Did you think of that at all? Did you Mm-mm. ever... Did you prepare for being on camera?
No.
And in front of the microphone?
No.
You've looked back at your tapes. What do you think of them?
I haven't looked back at them.
I looked back at them at the time,
mm-hmm. but that was all.
Did you expect to be convicted?
Sure.
You, once you were convicted, tried to get alternative service.
Yes.
What was the service that you were proposing?
To work with the Pueblos out in New Mexico. They had a strong need for somebody with a real estate law background. At that time, they were in a lot of property and water disputes, and it seemed to me that I could help them out.
But that was denied, the alternative service?
Yes.
When do you think alternative service is appropriate?
Any time that a defendant is not a danger, either to himself or to other people or to property, it seems to me that it's appropriate. I think there are some political cases, some highly notorious defendants that probably for purely political reasons can't be given alternative service. It would send the wrong signal, presumably either to the legislature or to the public at large or to some potential offender, and would water down the deterrent effect of conviction. And I, you know, that was present in my situation, I'm sure. But by and large, it's a big waste to send people to jail.
Do you feel that way, too, about some of the people who were sent to jail while you were in the Nixon administration?
Oh, I believe that about across the board. I just think incarceration is a form of social bankruptcy, except in cases of danger. We can devise all sorts of better sanctions than that.
Well, you spent 18 months in a minimum security prison in Arizona. Would you describe the conditions in that prison?
Well, it was just a place. I mean, it was half a dozen barracks on a patch of desert. It was full of Mexican aliens, primarily, who had been captured by the Immigration Service. There was a mess hall and an administration building and a powerhouse and a weight yard and a ball field and a miniature golf course.
Miniature golf course?
Yeah.
Do you mean a small golf course or one of the golf courses with pinwheels?
No, pinwheels and carpet and
right.
Really weird to see that there. It's sort of like the palm tree in Mr. Roberts.
Was that supposed to be rehabilitative? Or
no,
just...
it was something that some previous warden had decided would be a recreation for the inmates. It's just crazy.
Did you become like a prison lawyer in a way?
Yes.
Well, how did you work that? What were some of the things
you tried to do with people? Well, I was
basically
hereditary. You know, there were only a handful of Anglos in this place. And at one time or another, there was almost always one of them who was a lawyer or an ex-governor or something of that kind. And it became sort of his duty to look after the legal problems of the other inmates. It was about 4 hours' drive to the nearest big city, and so you couldn't get a public defender to come out there, and you couldn't get lawyers to come out there. So it just was a matter of self-help.
You also interviewed a lot of the Mexican prisoners while you were there.
Yeah, for a magazine piece.
Was for a magazine piece?
Right.
No,
I'll take it back. It became a magazine piece. And originally, I did it for a friend of mine in the Congress who was trying to understand the immigration problem, the illegal alien problem.
How did you get people to be candid with you?
Oh, well, I had
them thinking that you were going to betray their secrets.
I had a great roommate who ran the place, who was a Chicano. And once I persuaded Al that this was a useful thing to do, he caused these people to come in, and he put a cigar in their mouths and tell them to sit down and tell me the truth. And since he and his compadres ran the place, why, it wasn't too hard to convince them.
Did they feel bullied into telling you? Or?
No, they were very forthcoming. There was a certain implicit coercion in the fact that the invitation came from Al, but that's part of the territory there.
But you thought it was important enough to get their stories to justify that implicit coercion?
Well, it didn't bother me a bit.
There was a big press party at the prison, I think, the day before you were let out.
Yeah.
And then, because all the press was coming to film you and
cover
interview
my
you.
And rehabilitation, right. Yeah.
You described a little cover-up on the part of the prison while all the press was there. What did they do, the prison officials, to make the prison look better?
Oh, well, any time anybody was coming for an inspection, there was a periodic inspection by the federal judges, and there was periodic inspection by the higher-ups in the Bureau of Prisons. There was always paint-up, fix-up. The lawn got mowed. There's a little tiny patch of lawn out in this desert, and lots of painting, lots of straightening up, and so on. But on this occasion, new uniforms were issued, coats and ties for the guards, and they marched a whole bunch of the Mexicans off the property, beyond the line, down into an arroyo where they would be out of sight, because they were not considered to be sufficiently attractive for press scrutiny.
So they actually got rid of some of their prisoners for a while so that wouldn't be around for the press?
A couple of platoons of them, and then they sat down in the bottom of the gully over there.
Do you think you were changed by the time you spent in prison at all, having all that time to sit and think?
Well, I caught up on a lot of reading.
What'd you read?
Everything. Read everything H.L. Mencken ever wrote. For one thing, but a lot of current stuff, some Joyce, a lot, things you always intend to read and never quite get around to. And I did a fair amount of writing and so on. It changes you in the sense that it's an experience that you've never had before, and then it adds something from that standpoint. But as far as being a rehabilitative process, it is not. Not the way it's being run. I think the federal people will tell you that they make no pretense of rehabilitation.
My guest is John Ehrlichman, and he has been writing novels recently. His new novel just published is called The China Card. You started life again when you were out in New Mexico, where mm-hmm. I think you'd already moved before.
Yeah, I'd lived there for several years.
And you remarried. You have a child from the new marriage. What's your day-to-day life like now?
Well, 5 or 6 days a week I write in the mornings as soon as I'm through with breakfast. Generally quit for a late lunch, about 1:30 or long in there. And then we have the afternoons pretty much free. Michael comes home from school about 3 or so. Well, he gets out at 3, so he comes home about that time or I go get him. And we have the afternoons.
You grew a beard after the hearings and the trial.
Yeah, long time ago.
Did it have any symbolic significance to you or anything, or did you want to be less recognized in the streets?
Let's see, we'll get on the couch here. Oh, I don't know that that's so. It was good to do.
Okay. You are disbarred, so you can't practice law anymore. Would you practice law if you hadn't been disbarred?
No.
And you can't vote.
That's right.
Are there other rights that...
You want to know whether I would vote if I could? Probably not.
Why not? That's...
Well, I haven't seen very many people I want to vote for lately.
Are there other rights that were taken away?
I can't possess a firearm, but I never have possessed a firearm, so that's not very disabling.
You're still a Christian Scientist, which yes. You were before Watergate. Do you feel like your faith was tested at any point?
I suspect it was proved.
Do you think of the American public as being forgiving?
Yes. I think basically they are.
How have you experienced that?
Well, I'm not thinking of it so much in my own personal experience, because nobody's ever been very hostile toward me, except you. And but I think just generally, the American people tend to be forgiving in the long haul. If somebody goes out and levels with them, by and large, the American people come forward and say, okay, you know, take another chance. I think if the Nixon administration had done that at the appropriate time, that probably the president would have gone ahead and served out his full term.
Do you think I'm being hostile to you?
Oh, I'm just teasing you.
Okay. Do you think that Watergate has really soured people on politics? Do you think that they expect
no.
corruption now and that nothing fazes us anymore?
I don't think it's soured people. I think for a time, politicians generally were in bad repute. But, you know, it wasn't just Watergate. There was Abscam and there were a lot of other things that all seemed to pile on at one time. But I, in the last 5 or 6 years, I think there's been a real resurgence of interest in politics and a very healthy one. I think generally speaking, the quality of the Congress is better than it was. We're getting better people in and into local and state level politics. So I think it's probably more healthy for the pruning than it was before.
My guest is John Ehrlichman, who served 18 months for his role in the Watergate cover-up. He now lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and writes books. His new book is a novel called The China Card. You didn't go to China with President Nixon.
Right.
And there's a story behind that, I think, that he was afraid to send you as an advance man.
No, I was bumped by Dr. Kissinger, as a matter of fact, who didn't want me to go and advance the trip for fear the Chinese would try and negotiate with me.
So,
and he wanted somebody who was not of comparable stature or rank in the White House to go.
Do you think that the opening of relations with China was one of the great accomplishments under Nixon?
Oh, I'm sure it was.
Was there a lot of pressure on him to do that? How much of that was his idea?
I think it was all his idea. I think he came into office with that as one of the things that he wanted to try and do.
You got to China in 1983, wasn't it?
Yes.
What are the impressions there, do you think, of the Chinese people and Chinese government about Nixon?
Oh, they're very strongly pro-Nixon, very strong. He could have that country with a ribbon around it if he wanted it. They're very, very strongly for him.
A lot of the people who were convicted in Watergate have written books. You've written three novels and a memoir?
Three novels, a memoir, and a sketchbook.
A sketchbook?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the novels was made into a miniseries. Many of the people who were involved in Watergate have written novels or memoirs. Gordon Liddy, I should mention, even got to appear on Miami Vice. Have you read their books? Have you read all the
No.
Watergate novels and memoirs?
No.
Why not?
It just didn't seem like a very good use of my time.
Weren't you curious?
Well, I was curious enough to hire a researcher to do it when I wrote my memoir. And she, poor soul, slogged through all of them and gave me one and two paragraph synopses, so I didn't have to do all that.
You weren't curious to see what friends and former colleagues had written about a story that you were so intimately involved with?
In the case of a couple of them, and I'm hard-pressed to tell you which ones now, my researcher sufficiently captivated my interest that I read the books. But most of it is pretty dull going, and I didn't bother with it.
President Nixon had sent you an autographed copy of his book.
Yes.
Did you ever send him an autographed copy of yours?
I never did. He says he doesn't read novels, and I'll take him at his word.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been John Ehrlichman, and as you know, he was one of the people convicted in the Watergate trials. He served 18 months in a minimum security prison in Arizona. Since that time, he's written several books. A few of them have gone on to be bestsellers. His latest book is called The China Card, and it's a novel that's based on the opening of relations between China and the United States. It combines real and fictional characters, and it's just been published by Simon & Schuster, the title again, The China Card. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. It's 10 minutes to 5. You're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Right now we're going to hear from alto saxophonist Benny Carter.